Then let's move on to 27.
Who's going to do that?
Okay, yep. So the paper is about a couple of queries about a series of distinct goods or services, which are goods or services which are substantially the same and have the same pattern of transfer to the customer. And they've got the same pattern of transfer to the customer if the performance obligations are satisfied over time and you use the same method of recognising progress. And two, I suppose, relatively narrow questions have come up. The first one is, in order to apply the series provision, must the goods be delivered or the services be provided consecutively? And I think the feeling of the staff is that this isn't an explicit criterion, and although while you can see why there might be scope for confusion or why people might think so, where it does occur, the word consecutively isn't meant to limit it to only circumstances where delivery is consecutive. So the staff's short answer is no, they don't need to be performed consecutively. There can be gaps between them. I suppose the question then is how big a gap, too much of a gap. But that's the second. That's the inevitable lead on. The second question basically is, does the accounting for a series need to give the same results as if the goods or services were accounted for as separate performance obligations? And again, I think the staff's view is fairly clearly that the answer is no. Again, it's not an explicit criteria. The objective of this method, I think it's stated, is to actually simplify the operation of the standard and just make it more user-friendly to operate. And frankly, in that case, the point is lost if you have to recalculate it anyway to see if the result is different. So that's there's the views of the staff. Over to you for comments.
Yep. Comments?
Question one, question two, or take any comments?
Question two, just one comment that in the example that has been given, example C, when the method that is used in while we are taking it as a single performance obligation with distinct services, for the purpose of revenue recognition, the example uses the cost-based approach, and therefore you get a different revenue recognition in the both scenarios. We would like to point out that there could be instances where it is still a single performance obligation with distinct series of goods or services, where an output-based method of revenue recognition could also be qualified, in which case technically the same number would come in the revenue recognition on both sides. So just wanted to...
Yeah, I think you make a very important point, which is, you know, there are various assumptions in this example, and it certainly shouldn't be read other than what its purpose was in this paper. And so, you know, one of the things you'd have had to decide is this, is that effectively a cost-based measure of progress wasn't appropriate measure of progress. And, you know, that might not be the case in other examples, in which case, you know, you might get a more similar answer between the two different methods. And I think that's just an important point to bear in mind.
Okay. Mary, you want to...
If I could, because it's coming in on example C, it's another aspect of it. I think the other, even if you assume that cost to cost is appropriate here, it seems to me that this is assuming that the test of the entity is entitled to consideration for the work it has performed. Seems to be presuming that that's not just the units on which it has started work, but also would be entitled to some compensation for the items it has not started. Because if you looked at this and the entity ended up not ordering units 6 through 10, I think it would go back to the contract and whether or not you are entitled to that revenue from 6 to 10, and I don't know whether you'd factor that into your consideration of whether cost to cost is an appropriate methodology, or whether it would factor into your determination of the transaction amount and what you were being compensated for. So it's no concern about this example per se, but it's a concern about the risk of this example being read too broadly and being applied in a number of cases in which the entity might not, for example, have negotiated any terms that actually give it some recovery for the inefficiencies in the early period.
Tony.
In which case does it become different performance obligations?
There might be, and I think it's right that we did not complicate example C with other performance obligations, but maybe worth flagging that up.
So I understand the staff analysis, and I agree completely with the analysis on the second question, that the accounting outcome does not need to be the same, because the only way of proving that would be to account for them as separate performance obligations. So I agree with that. I also agree that the standard doesn't require them to be, the items to be delivered consecutively. Having said that, the basis does use the word consecutively a number of times, and I wonder if somebody wanted to look at that and say, well, actually, I don't particularly want to be in the series guidance, they might look at the word consecutively appearing in the basis quite regularly and wonder. I think Stuart alluded to it when he was introducing the topic. It does create a couple of judgments. So is a series, if I'm delivering you one of these every year, or one of these every 3 years, at what stage does it cease to be a series because the gap between them is too long? Yeah. Or is a three-year contract to provide audit services a series, or are they three distinct performance obligations that wouldn't meet this criteria? And so I think it does introduce some tensions. And I just wondered, you said maybe it's a question, Henry. This was obviously designed as a simplification to take away the stress that might arise from trying to, if you've got a daily cleaning service, saying I've got 365 distinct performance obligations, I've got to apply the model and do the allocation, and that clearly doesn't make sense. But I wonder, was it designed effectively or more as a practical expedient? Because it's actually mandatory.
Yeah.
And there are times where I think that's causing some tension.
My recollection of this a little bit is that there were really two dimensions to why this provision came in. Because, if you like, the practical expediency aspect of it was actually in the last exposure draft, but nobody really got it from the wording in the standard, but it was there in some of the illustrative examples. And the way it was worded in the exposure draft, people thought it was very much about just talking about concurrently delivered items rather than, for example, a repetitive service contract. So there was a sense of trying to make life a little bit simpler here, and so there was the practical expedience aspect of it. But I think there was another aspect of it as well, which was that people were a little bit troubled in the 2011 ED that the repetitive service contract might be chopped up into different performance obligations in different ways by different people. And therefore, I think people generally felt that, look, if you have this three-year cleaning contract, then that should be one performance obligation. It shouldn't be that, you know, Stuart did three and I did one. So there was that aspect of trying to bring a bit of rigor and consistency. Now, you can ask, well, how far was this meant to go? And I think some of the examples that have been raised sort of start to test this a little bit. But thinking about what you said a moment ago, I was just thinking, isn't it then it comes down to a question of saying, substantively, is it a series or is it not a series, really? And isn't then that's a judgment that needs to be made about whether you're caught by this or not caught by this.
I think there is a judgment that needs to be made. I think that some folks are struggling with the judgment, and there are some, I think, circumstances where you can get things that feel economically quite similar accounted for differently. So if I'm, for example, supplying electricity, can't be stored, consumed immediately, so you sort of get to over time, and therefore it can be a series. But if I was delivering oil or gas, for example, can be stored, probably not going to get to over time, going to get to point in time. You might say that economically those are very similar, but this model would drive accounting that is actually slightly different. I think it's for something that was designed as a simplification, and I think for the repetitive service contracts it works, is causing some tensions.
But it was also designed the way the criteria were built up in 23A was really designed to make sure that it captures something where each individual unit in of itself would have been an overtime.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of sort of stringing together a series of overtime obligations.
Yeah.
And so that was, I think that was thought through a little bit at the time. But I think almost alluding to really is whether it should be a practical expedient. And they just think then you might come back to some of the questions that arose, which sort of were the reason why this guidance came in, which is to try and get greater consistency and rigor around it.
Interesting whether anybody else has similar concerns, but it's just me.
James? Well, maybe just to reiterate what Tony said, I'm hearing a lot of questions about it. Why does something point in time give you a different, completely different answer when it economically looks very similar to an overtime? And the example Tony used is a good example, electricity versus gas.
I mean, one thing to note is that, you know, the papers use some examples where there's products and they get caught by the series. And I think it's quite important to realise that, you know, I think the board's thinking was that these type of examples that would get effectively caught by the series provision essentially really aren't contracts to deliver a number of units. The nature of the contract has become much more contract manufacturing service contract. I think that's an important thing to bear in mind when you're thinking about this question here. Although, of course, if you did have a contract to deliver lots of units, there might be practical ways you go about accounting for it. But it wouldn't be caught by the series provision.
Just to echo everybody else said, but I think I agree with the conclusion of the staff in the example too. So the both methodology doesn't necessarily come to the same result. But I think it would be helpful if we have a why it's coming to a different conclusion, and then could be a legitimate reason for this differences. And then particularly for this example, seems like a conflict in several guidance. Looking at the BC, the learning curve, yes, that is kind of notion that we can use that notion appropriately, but that is because we can charge to the customer at the beginning of the production when the cost is high. But this, looking at this two scenarios, two accounting policies, one separate form of the same. So that question raised that entity cannot charge to the customer a higher price than at the beginning. So if that is the case, would it really appropriately depict the transaction of this for this one single performance obligation? I think that make it more challenge to use continue to use the input methods rather than output method.
I think that if we could add some kind of legitimate reason, it's just a practical reason or difficult to measure, so something like that, then justify the different consequences. I think that'll be helpful.
I think you're touching on the same point that Rajesh and Mary were making earlier on, that considerable care is needed around this example. And I think actually there's an interesting piece of discussion in the basis for conclusions of I was thinking about when I was looking at this again. And it's in the part of the basis for conclusion that talks about the learning curve effect in BC 314, and I think it's actually relevant to this particular example.
All right, so we have general agreement. We've had some good discussion. When we get to these discussions about similar economic transactions that have similar economics come up with different answers. It's interesting, but how we deal with it is more interesting, and I wonder whether these are not post-implementation review type questions rather than pre-implementation. But it's just a thought on how far do we go at this stage, where people really don't like the result. Well, it might be clear, but you don't like the result for good reasons. It's a difficult decision. Okay, do we have any more papers?
No,
excellent, thank you. Well, I'll officially close.